All set?
Thanks.
All right, good afternoon, everyone.
Let's go ahead and get started.
All right, this talk was originally supposed to be with Steve Peschka and Tom. Steve Peschka is ill, and he will not be able to make it. For the Steve Peschka fans, we are going to lock the doors in the back and will not let you out. You will sit through this session. Tom, can you please announce?
Yeah, but we do have Steve in spirit, so any questions you have will be directed towards Steve. He's happy to answer them as soon as he can.
So Steve Peschka, for those who don't know, is huge in the SharePoint community, huge asset to SharePoint. I mean, he's been everybody's inspiration around stuff. So to try to replace him, we actually had to take two people, myself and the Kirk Evans. Kirk Evans is a blogger, works for Microsoft. He's a PFE. We still don't have enough brain power on this stage to actually represent Steve Peschka, but we're going to try. We have a lot of experience. On the agenda today, we're going to talk about authentication. We'll talk about the different modes. If you're in my claims migration talk, some of this stuff will be the same. If not, you'll get some additional information around some things. We're going to talk about OAuth. We'll talk about the app model and OAuth and what that represents and what that means to SharePoint. And we'll also talk about server-to-server authentication, which is a new model, new authentication model that's introduced in SharePoint 2013. We got some pretty cool demos to show you kind of the mechanics of how that works for OAuth and server-to-server. So if you haven't figured it out by now, SharePoint will be Windows Claims. You've got to move over to Windows Claims. The default authentication mode when you create a web application in the UI will be Windows Claims. You can migrate from Classic to Windows Claims. There's a way to do that, a couple PowerShell scripts to do that. Support for Classic mode will eventually be deprecated. And I know you've heard that word this week probably a lot, right? You've probably heard, well, Sandbox Solutions is deprecated and Classic Web Apps is deprecated. What we mean by that is we have to try to support backward compatibility for a lot of different products and a lot of different features, but eventually that backward compatibility becomes like an anklet to us. And we have to move the architectures forward. A lot of the architectures are moving out of the classic single domain and more into these global multiple domains, and in order to do that, the authentication mechanism has to change. They made a decision within the product group to move to claims mode. We have two different types of claims modes. We have Windows claims and we have SAML claims. SAML claims are for federation when you're actually reaching outside of the organization. So because of that, they made a conscious decision to say, hey, customers, we need you to move, but we know it's going to be painful. So we're still going to provide this mode, but you really have to start thinking about not using this in the future because we have to move forward. And we want you to come with us, right? It's not one of those things where we're going to abandon you like other non-Microsoft people where they just kind of dump and run. We don't want to do that. So when you hear the word deprecated, and I know it's big and gnarly, but deprecated basically means, hey, customer, heads up. The cool kids are probably not going to be doing this in a couple of years, and neither are we. So
that's and on that note, if you're thinking about when I should move, so technically we do support classic mode authentication, but the time to move is now. So if you're looking at building out a 2013 environment, you're going to go through the effort of doing the upgrade, which is basically a rebuild and moving content over. Now is the time to also think about moving over to the claims modes. Yep.
And authentication migration, there was a talk prior to this where we talked about the different modes and the different ways to migrate. So if you catch the replay, go ahead and catch it before this. It's migrate claims. If you didn't catch it, that's okay. You're going to run some PowerShell to actually migrate those user credentials over. So if you have a classic web app and you mount it to a classic web app that you've created through PowerShell in SharePoint 2013, you can run this PowerShell of the Convert SP web application, and it'll then turn those credentials from classic credentials of domain slash username to Windows claims credentials, the I:0W type format. So that's new support that's available in 2013. It is also available in 2010. The mechanism is a little bit different. The mechanics are still the same. I've got a content database. I'm going to migrate that content database using some PowerShell. All right, and if you don't migrate from Classic to Claims and you want to do it in SharePoint 2013, it's kind of not recommended because now you're taking on two migrations and a huge testing effort. it's better to test it and migrate it now and then just migrate clean later on. But if you don't, if you can't, totally understand, there are some options for you. Option one is to create 2013, one that uses Windows Classic. So in that case, you just create a new SP web application, and then you're going to pass the you're going to pass some parameters to it, the NTLM or Kerberos. And when you do that, SharePoint, when you run that PowerShell, it's going to bark at you. It's going to say, hey, we're not using Classic anymore. You might want to not think about this. So it's going to just give you a nice little warning message. Feel free to safely ignore that one if you know what you're doing, and then keep going. You're going to mount your content database, and then you're going to run convert. When we talk about running the conversion, we like to say immediately after, but we totally understand that there's going to be a time period that you're going to want to run in Classic, but don't make that time period too long. You want to make it a temporary condition where you're running in Classic mode on 2013, and then have a plan for actually migrating that web app over to Windows Claims. Option two is to create a Windows Claims web application in SharePoint 2013. Take a Classic one and bring it over, and then on the mount, it's going to say there's an authentication mismatch, and then do the conversion there as well. So that's the different scenarios there of what you can do and what you can actually support around migration. For those that are on the June CU, we introduced the capability to migrate multiple content databases at a time. So if you have multiple content databases per web app and you wanted to migrate, let's say, 10 of them at a time, for every web front end, you can migrate like two or three. What you don't want to do is pick a lot of these to migrate. And if the web apps are on the same web front end, then you have to be careful around this parallelism. What you want to do is spread the load around multiple web front ends. Could be the same web app, but multiple web front ends, because that processing is going to happen on that web front end. So you're going to take, let's say you have 10 content databases, you might take two, put them on web front end one, take the next two, put them on web front end two, and so on and so forth. So that's how you're going to do this parallel migration. This is only possible if you're on the June CU or later with SharePoint 2010, and it's also possible in SharePoint 2013 where you can do this parallel migration, and there's the PowerShell for that.
All right, so let's go ahead and take a look at a quick example of how we would actually do this upgrade. So just to reiterate what we just talked about, you have three options, really, when you're looking at doing an upgrade. And our preferred approach is always to try to go to claims mode, convert over to claims in your 2010 environment, and then move your content over. As we discussed, that's going to be the lowest risk option. You're able to isolate potential issues from your claims migration, from upgrade issues potentially going to 2013. What I'm going to demonstrate, though, however, is the other option, moving to a SharePoint 2013 web application pre-configured for Windows claims authentication using a database and sites that came from a farm that was configured for Classic mode. So my first step, so as part of every process, we're going to be attaching or mounting a database to your farm. You really want to go ahead and test that content database. So I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to run this quickly. Can everybody see that okay, by the way? Okay, great. So we're going to go ahead and run this, and we're going to do a quick test. And the reason why I did this is just because I want to show you the one message that you're going to be concerned about when you're moving your content over. So you can see here, and let me zoom in for you. What it's telling me here is the web application is configured for claims authentication. However, the content database you're trying to attach is intended to be used against the Windows Classic authentication mode. So in other words, it's saying, hey, listen, you're trying to mount some content from an old farm or from another web app that doesn't match the current configuration of this new web app. And it actually gives you a nice little link to take you right to the documentation on how to do the conversion to claims. And it actually works. So okay, so now we've tested our database. Everything else looks good other than this. This is what we expected. Other errors or issues could pop up here, especially if you have customizations and things you haven't moved over to your environment. But other than this one error, it looks like we're ready to mount.
All right, here we go. Thank you so much for sticking with us. I definitely appreciate it. Be kind on the evals, right? Fire alarms are not something we plan for.
All right, so where did we leave off?
We left off on our content database.
All right, so we just tested our SharePoint content database. So we found out, gee, we've got to convert this over to claims as we expected. So now the next step typically would be to mount that content database to the farm. For sake of time, I've already mounted it, so we're not going to go ahead and do that step. But what we're going to do is we're going to take a look now at that content database. We're going to go ahead and take a look at what sites are in it, and you'll see that you have a couple legacy 14 mode sites. So I'm going to go ahead and run that real fast. Okay, so we already mounted. Woo-hoo. All right. So you can see here I've got a couple sites. I've got svcdemo.local. I've also got a sites demo. Shameless plug for hostname site collections. Everything you see here is a hostname site collection. If you haven't heard about that, you might want to investigate hostname site collections. All right. So interesting finding here. So one of the things I've done in this script is I want to say, okay, well, you know, maybe I forgot, you know, who's the primary site collection owner on some of these sites. So what I did was I quickly dumped out an existing SharePoint 2013 site and dumped out the owner and got what I would expect, right? I've got, here's my Windows identity for the administrator in the environment. But now take a look at what happened when I tried to dump out the primary site collection administrator for those new sites I just mounted. When I come over here, you can see that site collection owner is null. Okay, that's a little weird because technically don't we always have to have one of those? That's why they call it the primary. All right. So, and in fact, actually, what's even more confusing maybe is when you go into central administration, I'm going to say, well, you know what, let me take a look at that site collection. I'm going to look at the site collection administrators. And I'm going to go and I'm going to pick my site collection. And this here's my demo site. Click OK. Oh, that's weird. I'm already there. Well, it should just work. So let's go ahead and let's bring open the site. So I'm going to go ahead and browse out to my dev site. So this is svcdemo.local. All right. And HTTPS. And wow, that's kind of weird. So I'm in central administration. It says I'm clearly the site collection administrator, but now also I'm getting access 9. And that's just to demonstrate that my classic mode Windows identity is not the same as my Windows claims identity. And so what we need to do is we need to convert that. So I'm going to go ahead back and I'm going to go back to PowerShell. PowerShell is our friend, and we're going to do a quick convert. So the method I'm going to use here is I'm just going to quickly use the convert SP web application commandlet to convert all of the content databases and the content in this particular web app. For my demo, I've only got a couple sites, so it goes pretty quick. But be aware that, you know, if you're going to run this in your production environment, this can take hours. So it's going to be a very long-running operation. So let's take a look at what I'm doing. So if I zoom in quickly, we've got the convert SP web application call. I'm passing in the identity, so here's my web app that I want to convert over. Notice it doesn't match the svcdemo.local. That's again because I'm using hostname site collections. I'm saying I want to go over to claims, I want to retain permissions, and that's it. So now I'm going to go ahead and run this, and you're going to see a couple warnings, and there's one I want you to pay attention to. So I'm going to go ahead and run. Okay, so the first one here, this one's like, okay, yeah, you're going to run something that's going to take a long time. Are you really sure you want to do that? For my demo, I'm going to say, absolutely, let's continue on. This one's interesting, though. So this one you got to pay attention to. And I believe you talked about this in your last session. So what this is telling us is this operation will add full rights to the web application for demo administrator. Do you want to continue? Well, you have to, because it's required for the conversion process to actually occur. However, once we've added demo administrator to the web application through web application policy, we don't actually remove that credential when we're done. So you can imagine if you've got maybe some farm administrators, they're going ahead and running this upgrade, you might want to go back and check your web application policies and clean that up after you're all done. So I'm going to go ahead and run this. And of course, this is a demo that'll run without error. Let's go ahead. It does actually take a second or two to run through. Yeah. This is when I need the fire alarm, by the way. A little bit of filler. So it's going ahead right now. It's actually going to check all the credentials and all the sites across all the databases, and it's going to go ahead and do the conversion. So, oh, look at that. I'm getting a little bit of a warning here. It looks like I've got one of our users that couldn't be converted. This is why you want to do your conversion before you go over to 2013. You could have handled it in 2010. Okay, but it looks like at least it was successful on my test site. So we have here, I've dumped out all the sites again. I'm still running in 14 compatibility mode, but now look at the site owner for that particular site collection. I can now clearly see I have a site owner that's a Windows claims identity. And just to test that, I'm going to go ahead and bring up that site one more time. And hopefully it should run without issue. And lo and behold, we're in the site. So that's an example of how to do an upgrade to claims.
Any questions on that process? pretty straightforward.
Yes, sir.
So the question is, what do we do about those failed users? So there's a few principles that will not convert just out of the box. One of them is the system principle. That's one that doesn't convert. The other one that doesn't convert is like any search crawl accounts that you had, any portal super user accounts. If they happen to log on, those won't convert. Otherwise, the other ones will convert. You can go to the log. There's a log that gets generated, and you can see what happened. If you want to have more information and more control over that, you could also plug in iMigrate users, which is just a way to plug into this process, this migration process, and actually have more control over the logging if you wanted to. But you can go to the logs, the upgrade logs, and see what actually happened with those user accounts. Some of those user accounts are expected though. Yes, sir. So the question is around search. Is the search account isn't in there? Will the search trimming still work? You still have to add that search crawl account back in. The ACLs are still there. It's just any additional crawls won't be able to get access until you give it that new credential, until you add that new credential. Hold on one sec. There was a question there. I'm sorry. Say that one more time. Also, the question is, if the user wasn't in Active Directory, is that expected? Yeah, if it could not find the user, it won't be able to convert them. If it's in a different AD, it won't convert them. But the message that you'll get is still the message that says, hey, I ran, but something might have happened. You'll have some migrated, some orphaned. That is correct.
Yeah, the process doesn't fail on the first error. So basically what you would do, and I didn't show you here for time, you would go to US logs, you would take a look at which users didn't move over, potentially rerun the convert if you had to. If not, just delete those user accounts.
How does that affect checked-out documents?
So the question is, how does that affect checked-out documents? So if the user account isn't in there, the user that gets shown for checked-out documents will still be the old credential. As an administrator, you probably have to override the lock if that user is not there. There was a question in the middle, and then I'll get to you. So the question is, will it also change permissions on workflows and alerts? It'll change the user credentials for workflows underneath the covers, but it will not change like the last modified user. Some of the metadata on the workflow that's inside the XML, you've got to go and republish those workflows if you want to get those identities connected again. As far as search alerts, I had that same question in my last talk. Search alerts in RTM might be different. I think they fixed that in RTM. In beta 2, it wasn't working. But search alerts should be working in as part of the migration for RTM. So search alerts will transfer. The December CU fixes the workflow issue. Awesome. Thank you. Question there. The question is there downtime during conversion? Yes, there is downtime. So the way to do this would be to take your content database, put it read-only, take that content database, mount it to another web app, migrate it, and then put it back. One more question, and then we've got to move on. Yep.
Okay. If you have an on-premise farm with just classic NTLM authentication and you don't have any kind of federation, why would you need, what are the top five things that won't work in 2013 if you don't upgrade to claims authentication?
So the top five things that won't work, I don't know if we can do five, so I can do one, web app preview. The Office web applications, those will not work. Preview within search won't work. That's one of them that won't work. I think some of our app stuff won't work.
Yeah.
Yep, the App Store won't work.
Yep.
I'm sure there's other stuff underneath the covers that won't work. Most of the net new features. Thank you. All right, moving on.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about the authentication infrastructure. So some of the improvements that we made, and actually this is a very nice improvement, is now we actually track the FedAuth cookie in the distributed cache to RIS. And what does that mean? So in 2010, what we did was we kept a copy of it on every web front end. And that was a potential issue for you if you weren't using sticky sessions. So you can imagine a large farm, I would authenticate to server one, and the session then would, the load balancer would bounce me out to maybe server two, I would have to re-authenticate. And then if I'm using SAML, and let's say for instance, authenticating against ADFS, I would actually get redirected back to ADFS and have to re-authenticate. There was actually an interesting little blog by Steve. He calls out an issue around this where if that happened enough times, you could actually simulate a denial of service against AWS. So it was always recommended to have sticky sessions. And of course, there's some cons to doing that. Now, because we're storing the cookie, the Fedoff cookie, in the distributed cache, when server A gets that cookie, it's able to put it in the cache. And then when I hit server B, that cookie is available to us. OK, some of the other features we've added in 2013 and actually ported back to 2010 as of the June CU. What we're allowed to do now is we can actually change the claims encoding. So we can now change the characters for the claim type. That's important when you're doing SAML to SAML authentication, if you've ever done that across farms or maybe across device to farm. What you had to do is make sure that your claim mappings mapped and matched in the exact order and exact type between both environments. What we're allowed to do now is we actually have a set of commandlets that allows us to pre-populate that and configure it, and so we don't have to worry about those mismatches. We can also add multiple token signing certs to the SharePoint STS. So where this is useful is in, again, in server-to-server authentication scenarios where you might actually want to have different certs for different endpoints.
The other thing that that's good for is in case of a certificate expiration. So if the certificate expires, you can actually give it another certificate now, and then the authentication isn't down while that new certificate gets spun up. So that's another reason why this is a good thing.
Absolutely. All right. And then, of course, we've improved logging. So if you've ever gone through and you've configured claims mode authentication, especially SAML with Federation in 2010, you probably were a bit frustrated at points trying to figure out, why can't I not authenticate? All sorts of fun things like encryption problems, signing problems, you know, expiration. There were all sorts of interesting issues, and sometimes it wasn't very clear to figure out what was going on. Now what we're doing when you look at the US logs, we have very verbose logging around claims because claims is the de facto default method of authentication. So if you're curious, if you really want to see what's going on under the covers, you can crank up the US logging up to verbose on claims authentication, and you're going to see quite a bit of information about how the system's actually processing the Fedoff cookies, putting it into cache, taking it out. If it has any issues with the Fedoff cookie, it'll go ahead and tell you that in the logs, which is very nice. All right.
So now let's move into a new facility in SharePoint 2013, which is OAuth. Thank you. What just happened there? There we are. So OAuth is an industry standard specification that's used through a lot of different implementations. One that a lot of people are familiar with is Facebook. When you add an application using Facebook, it's using OAuth too. So the benefit here is that you don't have to actually assign a Windows credential to an application. So it allows you to approve the ability for an application to act on a user's behalf. And the way that we do that is because through using OAuth, we're able to pass tokens that are signed between these two intermediaries so that we can pass this information and apps can actually act on users' behalf or be able to perform actions without requiring a username password combination. So for example, one of the things that we can do is allow users to share their resources. A common scenario that while we're showing the developer Ignite sessions is maybe even workflows. In SharePoint 2013, workflows actually use OAuth. And what you'll see is if you start to work with the new workflow in SharePoint 2013, if you do something like where you set the body of a list item, you'll see that it says updated by workflow on behalf of the user. So we have tracking not only for the app that is making the modification, but also the user that it was acting on behalf of as well. So the key is that the users don't have to provide the credential each time, and you don't have to provide a credential to the app itself. But so a lot of people, when they first see this, they think, oh, well, if we have OAuth in SharePoint 2013, does that mean that I can now use that for user sign-on? The answer is
no.
We do not have user sign-on for OAuth. We still only use WSFed as the sign-on for users. So you won't ever see anything like sign in with Facebook unless you know you custom code that yourself, but you're not going to be able to do that with OAuth. And that's the key message here, is that you're not going to see OAuth providers. If you go into Central Admin and you look at the trusted providers that you have in there, that's usually below the FBA section, you're not going to see OAuth providers listed in there. That's, again, only that's the WSFed-based providers. So how it does work is, allows users to authorize SharePoint to perform actions on their behalf. So OAuth can't just happen. Users have to grant permissions. And you'll see this as you add new app functionality into your SharePoint 2013 sites. As you add an app that needs to do something, it'll prompt you and say, do you trust this app? And then it'll have a list of permission requirements that the app is advertised to say that it needs to perform work. The app won't be able to perform anything that it has not been explicitly granted permission to. And even better is that an app cannot be used to elevate user privilege. So if the user does not have privilege, let's say, to read from a list, they can't use an app to bypass that security. This is not the same as like run with elevated privileges or some of those weird things that we did with development SharePoint 2010. If the app doesn't have permission, it's going to fail. And further, if the user doesn't have permission, the call will fail as well. So both of those must occur for the permission, for the action to occur. So each token can be used to access different resources, such as a specific site or a specific resource, such as a set of documents. Or we can even constrain the permission request based on things like a template type, such as I only want them to have permissions to the announcements list. So we have the ability to grant permissions there as well. So it allows users to be able to grant permission to SharePoint without, again, sharing username, without sharing password. And this is an important part of the advancement of apps in SharePoint 2013. So the typical scenario of how you would do this is the user would sign on, and they're going to be authenticated. And the user then opens up a hosted app, such as something that's hosted in Azure. When we install the app was granted permission at install time, again, through that do you trust this app dialogue, which is part of the OAuth. The app is then granted permission to use an embedded iframe. This iframe is typically hidden, and the iframe is then going to be used to render the data from the remote resource, and that remote resource then will need to call back into SharePoint to access data. There's another step in that call back into SharePoint access data because it needs what's called an access token. So in order to grant the access token, what we use is this thing called access control services out in Azure. So the flow kind of looks like this. The client makes a request to SharePoint. And once they make the request, we can see that the page includes maybe an app part. So it includes an app sitting on there. Again, when you look at the SharePoint 2013 UI, you'll see that everything's an app. Lists are app. Everything's an app. Well, in this case, we have a specific context of what we're calling an app. It's an app that actually uses the new OAuth-based framework. When you create an announcements list, this doesn't occur. But when you actually go out like to the marketplace and add an app, this is exactly the scenario that we're talking about. So we make a request, HTTP request, to the SharePoint server. The next step is that we need to render the app from intranet.contoso.com. So how we do that is SharePoint will start using OAuth to make to request a context token from Access Control Services, the ACS. In this case, ACS is acting as a secure token service, or STS. It returns back a signed context token, and then that in turn is going to SharePoint will render the contents, which is the .aspx page including that hidden iframe I just mentioned a moment ago. When it renders this, we see the iframe is referenced in the DOM in the browser. So then the browser knows to go back and request the contents for that iframe to the remote resource. So we request the iframe contents to the remote resource. That remote resource then needs to go to ACS to be able to ask it for what's called an access token. In order to be provided the access token, it provides a refresh token. So we have a couple of tokens in play. One is the context token. Then we provide the refresh token to ACS, which then in turn provides the access token back. Once we've acquired the access token, we provide that to SharePoint and say, here's the request for data that I have using either OData or the new client or some of the additions to the client-side object model. And then from there, SharePoint returns data back to the app, which then it can render using JSON or using a jQuery or whatever it needs to be able to render the data, which finally is rendered to the user as part of the app that was sitting in the default.aspx page. Any questions on this? Yes. So the question is that we overloaded yet another name and that we had something else called access control, and the question is about reusing the name and that it's causing confusion. Yeah, we called it app. By calling it app, there's the most overloaded term. Now try to describe somebody what a web app is without confusing anybody about web app and an app, and there's an app for that. So. It is a completely different model. This is the same thing as access control services inside Azure. So we have a specific context for that inside Azure. Another question in the yellow shirt.
Can you use non-ACS SPS for this, or is it an offline scenario, like completely interconnected?
So the question was, what I've just pointed out is that in this scenario, using OAuth, we need to be able to contact ACS, which is obviously sitting in the cloud as part of Office 365. So is there a scenario where you can do this offline? The answer is yes, and Tom's going to talk about that next when we talk about server to server. Any other questions? In front, yes, sir. Yes. So the question was that whenever we do sharing, and they demonstrated this in the keynote, when we do sharing to somebody that's outside of our organization, something like Windows Live ID, how do we accommodate that? And do we do that through OAuth?
So the answer is kind of. So the simple sharing out in the cloud, what we actually do is create an account for you. This is going to get really complicated really fast. If you're just in the cloud, there's actually an Active Directory up in the cloud. And if you have an ACS, if you have an Office 365 tenant, you have an instance of ACS that you can call to. So that's the instance that we're talking about here, is your custom ACS tenant. When you invite people to that Office 365 simple sharing, you go to simple sharing UI, we bootstrap an account for you, for that user outside. We bootstrap an account, and then that account gets access. And when you authenticate, we then map you and then get you access to that thing, and then that thing is... you're basically a shadow account in the cloud. You can't authenticate with that shadow account. You can only authenticate through Live ID, and the only way you can get to that particular account is by authenticating with that original Live ID. So we basically link you and then bootstrap you to that account. So that's what's kind of happening behind the scenes around that.
And again, the biggest thing we want to remember here is that there is no user authentication with OAuth, which that would obviously require authentication for the user to be able to access. Oh, there was another question?
Yeah. What are the things that cannot do? You mentioned that it cannot run with the database privileges to digital IP. Can you next
we're going to talk about that now, and then if you still have questions, then we can sync back up.
So the question was, what can an app not do? And we're going to talk about
that. Okay. So yeah, for the recording, the question was, what can an app not do? And the question was like around things like run with elevated privileges, or I'll even embellish that a little bit. What happens with things like timer jobs or application pages? So let's move on.
So great question. So let's talk about application permissions. So now in 2013, applications are a security principle onto themselves. So that means that we can now bind to that principle certain permissions within the site or to services. So how do we do this? All right, so an app has to request the permissions it needs at installation time. So I'll show you when we create an S2S example, there's a manifest file where that application developer is going to specify clearly, I need access to this type of content or these services with a particular right or a set of rights at a particular scope. The developer is going to put that in their manifest file and state that those are the permissions that are needed. Then when you install the app, the user is going to be prompted with an installation page that's going to say, this application requires, let's say, read access to this particular list in your site. Do you trust this application before you install it? And what's going to happen here is if the user chooses to install, at that point, that user is saying, yes, I trust this app, and from this point on, until I revoke the entire permission set, I trust this application now to come in and access that content, that list. The user that's doing the installation, first of all, has to be at least a site owner to actually install the app, but in addition, has to have the permissions required that the application is requesting. So if the application is requesting certain permissions, maybe to go talk to a project server or search, and the user doesn't have those permissions to grant, it can't actually grant that to the application. All right, so when do we set up app rights? So this is given when we install applications. What we're doing is explicitly granting that permission, either if I'm a tenant administrator, so I've got a number of site collections in a tenant, or I'm a particular web app administrator, I'm granting that app the permissions that it's requesting. We also set app rights when the application is removed. So once we remove the app, we remove the permissions. Once we provision, we can't actually change that permission set we've granted. So you can't run into a scenario where, let's say I've installed an application and it's accessing lists in my site, and then I realize, well, there's one list I really didn't want it to have access to, so I'm going to try to change the permissions. That's not supported. The reason why we do this is so that applications don't break after installation, right? So we want to make sure that there's a great user experience, and if we decide that there's a particular application we no longer trust because of one of the permissions we granted, we want to go ahead and remove that application and revoke all the rights. Okay, so we have application rights at particular scopes. So what we have here listed below are the typical scopes you're going to be dealing with when you're looking at content. So when I'm granting rights to an application, I might say it has a particular right across an entire site collection, it has a right at a particular website or web, at a particular list level, or at a tenancy level. So if you're familiar with tenancies, really just think about this as an administrative boundary across a number of site collections. There's also additional scopes that we don't have listed here for the additional types of requests that applications might be making. Things like to go and talk to search, accessing the taxonomy store, user profiles, some of the other services in the platform. Okay. If the application is granted permission to a scope, the permission applies to all the children at that scope. So in other words, if I say, yes, you have access to this particular web, now I have access to all the content in that web for whatever permission was requested. Where this doesn't apply is if I have permission to a particular web and then there's a subweb in my environment, unless I've been given the site collection scope rights, I don't have permission to that subweb. Okay, the types of permissions. So similar to permission levels for users, we have out-of-the-box permission levels for applications. So when you're going to go ahead and make a request, I'll show this in the manifest file, you're going to specify a scope and then a particular permission you want. So I want either read-only, a write, manage, or full control. Where this differs slightly from the user or the permission levels that you're used to is that you can't change this. So unlike regular user permission levels, I can be very granular about what they actually do. These are actually baked into the product. Okay, so how do we set up high trust applications? So the way this all works under the covers is through the exchange of certificates. So what you need to do is, and I'll demonstrate this in a second here, is you need to create what we call a new trusted security token issuer. This is a new commandlet. This is very similar to the identity token issuer commandlet. However, it's very different in the fact that it actually provides a very different type of token. So just be careful when you're actually doing autocomplete in your PowerShell session that you're not actually trying to configure an identity security token issuer. Really what we are is looking at the trusted security token issuer. If you ever want to stop trusting an app, so this is an interesting thing. If you've decided that you have one certificate, let's say in your organization you want to make it easy for developers, I want to have one certificate, be the trust broker for all the applications in my environment, you can certainly do that. You can configure that, that's an option, or you can configure per application a particular certificate with each app. If you go with one shared certificate, you do have the scenario to think about where you might want to stop trusting a particular application. You want to basically revoke at the certificate level its permissions to come back in and access content. If you've used only one certificate through your entire environment and all apps have shared that, guess what? You can certainly revoke the certificate, but now you have to go back and update every single one of those applications. So that can actually be quite a challenging process. Okay, so if you do decide that, hey, I'm going to use a single certificate, I'm just going to do this maybe for all my internal apps because I know I trust all my internal developers. So a couple things you have to be aware of. So there is a flag on the commandlet where you're going to create the SP Trusted Security Token Issuer. You have to specify that this is a trust broker. This is required to enable one certificate to be used across multiple apps. What you want to make sure of, and this is actually something you're going to see if you've downloaded Preview 2 for the Office Tools for Visual Studio. As of Preview 2, when you create a new application in the provider-hosted model, you're going to see that what you get is not only a client ID, but this concept of an issuer ID. And so what issuer ID allows you to do is you have one common issuer that identifies the trust relationship for all apps that share that issuer, but each application has its own individual client ID. So that allows you scenarios where you want to uniquely identify just an application instance, but all those application instances want to be able to go back to a single STS for their tokens. So let's go ahead and take a look at an example of how we would set all this up. We'll go ahead and switch back over to the demo. Okay. Actually, let's take a look at this from the administrative view first. So I'm going to go ahead and show you what the administrator would do. So first of all, we need a certificate. So we need to create a certificate, and we actually need to have two versions of that certificate. One, we need to have the PFX file that actually has the private key. This is something that we're going to have to share out with the application owner. That's what's going to be used to sign the token that's passed back to SharePoint. And then we need the .cer file that's basically the certificate without the private key. So if you're not familiar with that process, I'll show that to you quickly. What we can do is we can go off to IIS. I'll just bring up a site. And I'm going to come in here. I'm going to take a look at some of the certificates installed on my machine. Okay, and I've got one cert here. So if I wanted to export this out with the private key, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to say export. I'm going to give it a path, an actual password. The password is important. You're also going to have to give the password when you give out the certificate. And then I save it to the local machine, and that's going to be saved as a PFX file. Now, if I want to get the .cer file, we take a slightly different path. What you do is you basically view the certificate. So I'm going to go ahead and open this up, view it, go to details. And then in details, I click copy the file. And at this point, what we're doing is we're exporting it, and I have the option to say, no, don't export with private key. So I click through. Basically same process, you can leave the defaults, next, give it a file, doesn't have a password, and then you should have both a PFX file and a .cr file to move forward. Okay, close that out, and back to our PowerShell. Okay, so the PowerShell is actually pretty simple. So what we're doing here is I've just go ahead and I've added the snap-in for SharePoint. I've set up a couple variables here. So what I have is on the local machine, my certificate without private key. I'm going to need that when I configure my token issuer. I have an issuer ID. Remember, this is something new. So if you've seen previous demos or even content up on MSDN, they might have referred this to as the client ID. So now we have both a client and an issuer. So this is now our unique issuer ID. This is something that you would just generate. So this is a unique GUID. Make sure it's lowercase. You would share this out with the application owner or developer. I have the URL. So this is the URL to the site where I'm going to be deploying the application. So a couple things I do here. So just go ahead and I start off. I just get the SP web object, just making sure that I have it before I move on. Now, the next thing I'm doing is I'm getting the authentication realm for that particular web where I want to deploy. I do that through the service context of the site collection which it belongs to. I get the realm, and then finally, I use both the realm and the issuer ID to come up with the full unique app identifier. The app identifier is actually what you're going to use when you create your new trusted security token issuer. So again, the new commandlet is new SP trusted security token issuer, not the identity token issuer. I give it a unique name. It has to be unique. I specify the certificate, so I've loaded that previously. The registered issuer name, this is where I pass that full identifier. And then finally, in my example here, I'm actually going to be potentially configuring multiple applications. So I'm going to say, yes, this is a trusted trust broker. Finally, so now we've created an STS. But again, remember, the applications in 2013 are now principals onto themselves, right? So this means that I have to register a principal for the application, and then I have to grant it particular rights. So what I'm doing here is exactly that. So we have a commandlet for register SP app principal. Again, name identifier. This is the same identifier we've generated above. The site for which I'm granting permissions, and then finally a display name. And that's it. So once I've configured the trusted token issuer and I have the app principal in place, now I can go back and develop my application, deploy, and test. And we'll show you that in a second. So I'm going to go ahead and run this. Okay. All right, so the first thing, yes, it got the web, it exists, that's good. All right, next. Should be getting the site and getting the authentication realm. It's thinking real hard. Let's try one more time. Okay, sorry, I didn't hit enter. Okay, so we have, that's user error. So we have the authentication realm for the site collection. So you can see there, it's a unique GUID. This is very user-friendly, by the way. I love typing GUIDs. So we have...
my GUID.
Yeah, exactly. So here's the realm. So now what I'm going to do is I combine both that issuer ID and the realm, two GUIDs in one, and that becomes now my super unique identifier. Okay. So the rest of the code, what it's doing here, I'll scroll up. So we're saying, okay, we're creating a trusted security token issuer for... And you would never in a million years want to type that yourself. But that is the unique identifier for this app. And what we've done is now you can see we've dumped out that token issuer. So you can see that the sign certificate is the certificate that I've specified. We have the endpoint information. We have basically all the information that you would have for an STS. So I'm going to go ahead and continue on. Now I'm going to create that app principal. So now the application is an identity which I can grant permissions to in my environment. Again, we have this wonderful name identifier, and if you thought that was not enough, you can actually see the claim, identity claim for that. So, because we can't add enough characters to a unique identifier. And then finally, a display name. Okay. So now moving on. Now we're going to go see a little bit of the developer side. This is not a developer session, so I'll keep it brief. So now I'm going to come over. So remember, this is the example of creating an application that's going to be provider hosted, where the application can exist on-premise with SharePoint on some other application server. Technically, it doesn't even have to be IIS, ASP.NET. We actually have examples of that this week. In this case, we're going to look at a very simple ASP.NET example. So I'm going to go over to my developer server. Okay, I'm going to look at Visual Studio. And there's just a couple things I want to call to your attention. So first, let's take a look at the app manifest. So a couple things. One, what we have is the client ID. So the client ID is what we specified in the PowerShell previously. So you would share that with your developer. Remember, so I'm actually using Preview 1 of the Office tools. Preview 2 you're going to have an additional identifier, which is going to be your issuer ID as well.
And I'll put up a slide. I forgot to put it in here, but I'll put up a slide. It is fresh off the presses about how to get the download to the new preview, because it just got released yesterday, and we just found that out.
Yep. So then in addition, so now we have the permissions that we're requesting. So remember, in the manifest, the developer says, I need a certain set of permissions and permission levels on certain objects so that I can perform whatever the function of the application is. So that's, again, in the manifest XML. So you can see I've got a permission request. At this point, the scope is a web. It looks like a URL. It is a URL, but it's just a unique identifier for a scope, right? So this that actually doesn't mean anything other than I want the web scope level. And then finally, my write. And so in this case, well, in our example, we just need to read permissions. Okay. The next thing we'll take a look at is the web.config file, which your developer will create. So a couple things you're going to get out of the box. When you create a new provider-hosted application, you get the project and all the default project files. You'll get a web.config, and it's going to have the client ID and the client secret. You're also going to have an issuer ID in the next release. You have to add, however, your client signing certificate path and your certificate password. So remember, what the application is going to do is it's going to use the private key. It's going to sign the token with that private key, so it needs to know where do I get the PFX file, and then I have to be able to open it to get the private key, so what's the password? So you have to go ahead and specify that. Finally, we have just in the default ASPX file, not a lot of code here. The only thing we're doing here is we're just getting our client context from our URL, and then we're going to go ahead and we're going to execute a CSOM query back to SharePoint, and we're going to say this is the current site that we're running in. So we're going to go ahead and show you what that looks like. I'm going to go ahead and run this. So remember, we've already set this up server-side, so if your developers are trying to do this and they can't figure out why it's not working against their dev sites, it's probably because you haven't configured this server-side. Also bear in mind that for this to work, you have to have had a profile import. So the way S2S works under the covers is it actually has to hydrate the user or the identity for the user through the profile store. So I'm going to go ahead and run this quickly. I'm going to say start. It should pop open the site. Okay, it's because I'm using a fully qualified name. It's not trusted, so I'm going to go ahead and type in credentials real fast. Should pop open my site. It's going to ask me for permissions. One more time. One more time. And come back down here. Okay. Yeah, so this is the screen that I was talking about previously. So this is right now where you're actually saying, I trust this application and the permission set required. So I'm going to say, of course I trust it. I'm going to go ahead and trust it. And now, lo and behold, I now have that application deployed to my site. So I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to run this. And because I'm going back to localhost, this is a developer machine. The SSL certificate's not trusted. So I'm going to go ahead and say continue anyways. Okay. And I've now retrieved the web title using the client object model, using the permissions of the user. So that's basically our high trust scenario. OK, so let's finally wrap up. Let's talk about server-to-server auth, basically S2S, which is more or less what we just demonstrated. OK, so again, this is a scenario for application-to-application OAuth. So what we're doing is we're setting up S2S for well-known application principles. Our application principles in 2013 are SharePoint, Exchange, Link, and Azure workflow server. So in a common scenario here, you might want to set up trust between your SharePoint environment and Exchange so that you could get through the site mailbox, you can synchronize tasks, perform operations on behalf of the user on both sides of the fence. Okay, to do this, we require user profiles. So what's going to happen is when I need to pass a user context over to, let's say, for instance, Exchange, what's going to happen is SharePoint under the covers is going to construct that token, and it's going to look at the user profile store, and it's going to require, at minimum, a UPN, SMTP, and SIP attribute so that I can hydrate a token, and I'm going to go ahead and send it over to whatever application I trust. OK, Okay. So for this to work, we have to configure user profile mappings. So if I'm using FBA, so with Windows, you know, this pretty much works out of box. You're not going to have any issues. But if you're using FBA or SAML, there's additional work here. So remember, if I'm required to have UPN, SMTP, or and a SIP attribute, I'm going to have to either have a custom sync connection or a sync job or something on the back end that for each one of those FBA users, I'm populating the profile database with those attributes. In addition, also any memberships those people might have with role claims.
So the question is, can we use the app model with OAuth server-to-server trust with SharePoint Foundation? That's correct. It's because SharePoint Foundation does not have user profiles. So as far as the app model, most of what we talk about here for apps, when you're installing apps, is not for Foundation.
Right. For S2S scenarios.
For S2S scenarios, for server-to-server scenarios. So this is a scenario where I've got SharePoint and Exchange, or SharePoint and Link, on-prem. That's the scenario that we're talking about here. So the question is, would we be able to do high trust apps in Foundation? The answer is no, not in Foundation. You have to have a user profile.
Okay. So moving on. So again, just like FBA, we also have the same issue to address with SAML. So again, you know, if we are going to be using S2S trust, we have to populate the profile database with the UPN, SMTP, and SIP attributes. We also have to look at the group membership, so the role claims. So we're going to do one of a couple things. We're either going to have a sync job, inserting that into the profile database, or you know, we can do a custom claims provider augmentation. So as part of the process, if you do have custom claims providers, those claims providers will get called so that you can potentially do claims augmentation at the time SharePoint needs to grab that token. So how is the platform used? So actually, we use it in quite a few spots. Where you'll find this most common is in scenarios like e-discovery. So you saw from the keynote this week, you know, we have the ability now to crawl and look at content across both SharePoint and Exchange and extract that content and save it off for e-discovery scenarios. It's able to do that through S2S. Another example, which we also saw, was task management. So again, it's that deep integration between SharePoint and Exchange. And also Team Mailbox is another classic example of this.
So one of the common confusion points on this is when we say server-to-server, we usually use the term high trust in the same connotation. And the reason that we call it a high trust app is not because it means that the app just has full control to do whatever it wants. That's actually not the case. When we say high trust, it means that we've specifically used the new SP security token issuer commandlet to be able to register it, and that establishes the high trust that the app that's using this can assert whatever identity it wants. The validation of that identity is done through user profile. So again, when you see the term high trust, don't assume that it means full control of the farm. That's absolutely not the case.
Yeah, it's very common to confuse that with full trust solutions, right? Because we've been saying full trust for a number of years now. Two very different things. Okay. So for the sake of time, I'd like to respect everybody's time. Thank you for sticking around through the fire alarm. Really appreciate that. So what I'm going to show you is a quick PowerShell script for how you configure S2S with Exchange. Basically, it's the same process as what we just looked at, so we don't have to go through everything in great detail. But I do want to show you a couple subtle differences, in particular using a metadata exchange endpoint to actually exchange certificates. So this particular PowerShell script is available on TechNet, so you can download it and use it in your own environments. We haven't changed anything here. All right, so a couple things going on. This script actually does a lot of things. It's going to check a number of the input parameters, check to make sure that you've got Exchange Web Services configured correctly. So that's the benefit of using this. But really what we want to look at is just basically the same thing that we did with our S2S scenario with our provider app is the setup of the token issuer and the application principle. So if we come down, there's a couple things that we're doing that's a little bit unique here. So the first thing I'm doing is I'm grabbing the location of my Exchange server auto-discover metadata endpoint. So if you remember from the previous sample, I physically had to pass a certificate. The application had to have the private key. SharePoint had the certificate without private key. In this case, the only thing we have to do is just know the metadata endpoints. When I create my trusted security token issuer for Exchange, what I'm doing here is first look to see if it exists. But when I create it, we go ahead and look at the metadata endpoint instead of specifying the certificate that we need. Okay. Once we've configured the security token issuer, the next step, just like in our custom application example, is to go ahead and create an application principal. So what I'm doing is getting that application principal and then setting the application principal permissions, specifying that it basically has full control over the entire site subscription. If you're curious to see what the metadata endpoint actually returns back when you're running this, we can actually take a look at that. It's just JSON, so let's go ahead and look at what it looks like. Let me go ahead and bring up my auto-discover metadata endpoint. Okay, and so this is basically just a JSON object, but notice here that we have the 509 certificate and the value. So this is what allows us to actually configure the SSH trust with actually specifying the certificate.
Yeah.
It keeps going. But under the covers, conceptually, the same thing. Okay, so let's wrap it up here. So we talked about the new authentication modes in 2013. Technically not new, but what we're saying is now the default installation mode is to create web applications in claims mode. We really want everybody to be migrating as soon as possible to claims, whether that be Windows claims, SAML claims, or FBA claims. We took a look at OAuth and how OAuth is used to allow applications to authenticate with SharePoint to be able to either act on the behalf of the user to access content. And then we also looked at server-to-server authentication scenarios where we're integrating with things like well-known app principles such as Exchange, workflow server, et cetera. So with that, I'd like to open up the floor for any questions we might have. Questions?
Questions.
Could you step to the mic so they can hear you on the recording?
Would it be possible to set up your own metadata endpoint for your own HITRUST applications?
Is it possible to set up your own metadata endpoint? Yes, absolutely. Yes, if you want to go ahead and do that, you can.
Okay. Hi, just trying to understand this HITRUST scenario. So are we saying that normal applications sort of exposed to the marketplace can only impersonate the user executing the request, and that a HITRUST application is such they can go impersonate any user they want without that request coming through from the user in the first place?
Yeah, so there's actually three different policies that could be enforced here. So we either do, by default, we're doing application plus user. So basically, I cannot access any content that both the current user and the application cannot access. But then there's also the app-only mode, in which case what we're doing is saying, okay, whatever the application has permission to, regardless of what the user has, they can access content. To do that, there's actually some additional there's an additional attribute that you need in your manifest to say, I require the app-only policy. And then in addition, when you're writing your code, you'll see that there's a different type of token you have to grab from the token helper class to actually go off and make that type of request. And then the final mode is also, the final policy is just user. So you have app plus user, you have app only, and then user.
Sorry, I still don't quite follow. So are we saying in the user or app plus user, if it's a high trust scenario, then it
if it's a high trust scenario, and we've configured the policy for app plus user, that application coming back in is only going to be able to access content that both the application's been granted permission to and the current user has permissions to. If I'm executing a method where I'm using the app only policy, what's going to happen there is, regardless of the user identity, the application's going to be able to access content that it's been granted access to. And that's on a per method basis. So that's not something that you just blanket grant to the entire application. That has to be done explicitly not only in the definition of your manifest file, but it also has to be done in code itself.
Okay.
Clear as mud?
Yeah, yeah. I'll come and talk to you after.
Okay, we'll talk later. Any other questions?
Yep. There used to be some BI scenarios that didn't work with Windows claims. Have those been worked out? I'm thinking mainly around like PowerPivot.
Good question. Yes. So we have quite a few changes in the BI scenarios. Short answer is, yes, they work now. There are some scenarios that are no longer available. For instance, like Visio doesn't do claims to Windows token translation for per user delegated identity. There's other things that have changed, and I'm going to talk about that in my session on Thursday. You do have to be aware, though, there is going to be subtle differences between what you can do with Windows claims versus FBA and SAML. So we still have the restrictions with the claims Windows token service. Okay. But now that's one of the benefits, that now that claims is the de facto default authentication mode for the product, there was great efforts made to make sure that all the services work in that mode.
Okay, great. Yeah. Thanks.
Okay, any other questions?
Thank you so much for your time.
Yes, thank you
so
very much
for hanging out with us.
Yes, really appreciate the patience through the fire.